and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. And our top story today, the reaction and response to President Trump's decision to suspend all military aid to Ukraine with immediate effect. It follows days of criticism from the Trump administration directed personally towards the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And of course, it follows that dramatic public row in the Oval Office on Friday between Mr. Zelensky, Mr. Trump and his deputy, J.D. Vance. In the next few minutes, we'll look at what European nations and other allies can do to come to Ukraine's assistance. Can they fill the substantial gap in funding and military hardware that this move leaves? And we'll also get reaction from Ukraine. Does Kyiv still see the United States as an ally, considering that so far Mr. Trump hasn't suggested a single clear concession that he wants to see from Moscow ahead of any peace deal? And in fact, he's barely even criticised Mr. Putin and his invasion of Ukraine since he returned to the White House. Well, while European and NATO allies are scrambling to understand the new US position, in Russia, Mr. Trump's decision to withhold aid to Ukraine has gone down very well. President Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov gave his reaction during a phone conference with reporters.
Of course, the details have yet to become clear. But if this is true, then this is a decision that could really push the Kyiv regime towards a peace process.
Well, in an interview with Fox News ahead of the decision, US Vice President J.D. Vance said it was up to Ukraine to decide if it wanted peace.
This is not going to make anybody happy. The Russians are going to have to give up stuff. The Ukrainians are going to have to give up stuff. You can't come to the Oval Office and say, give us security guarantees. We won't even engage with you about what we're willing to give up. That's been the Ukrainian posture. When that posture changes, as President Trump said, when they're willing to talk peace, I think President Trump will be the first person to pick up the phone.
Well, let's head to Washington, D.C. now to our correspondent, Tom Bateman, who joins us live. Tom, thanks for coming on. First, can you explain exactly what Mr. Trump has suspended in terms of military aid, and do we know if it covers things like air support or intelligence?
Well, the White House, first of all, has characterized this as a temporary pause, but it has been perhaps deliberately very vague about the exact details of what will be suspended and for how long. Now, what we know about American military assistance to the Ukrainians is it comes through different programs. Now, some of those are what's known as presidential drawdown authority. That is literally when the President of the United States, having had the money authorized already by Congress, basically dips into existing stocks or stocks about to be manufactured by U.S. defense companies and gives those supplies to the Ukrainians. Now, that tends to be a faster process, albeit can still take many months. And that pipeline was still continuing under authority that had been given by President Biden. So those items will be stopped, and that will basically be immediate. And it seems to be, or at least the suggestion is, that stockpiles that were even in bordering Poland will now not be delivered to Ukraine. So that is an immediate stop. There are other programs of assistance, though, which basically involve American money that's paid for the weapons, but the contracts are between the Ukrainians and American defense manufacturers. Now, it's not clear whether or not those will cease, because legally, the Ukrainians own those items, even though the Americans have paid for them. There are, however, ways in which the White House could try to stop those as well, using sort of quite convoluted rules under national security considerations. We don't know from the White House the extent of this, but clearly, you know, this is a pause that will affect a significant amount of weapons. Mm. It will affect air defenses like ammunition for Patriot missile defenses, and crucially, artillery and artillery rocket systems like the U.S. HIMARS system, which, you know, the Ukrainians desperately need on the battlefield. And even if this leads to a sort of rationing of the material that's put into the battlefield because they fear this delay in the pipeline now, it will clearly have a very immediate effect, I think.
And very, very briefly, as you mentioned there, this package of aid was voted through Congress last year, wasn't it? Does the president actually have the authority to unilaterally reverse that decision taken by lawmakers? And might this actually go down quite badly with some Republican lawmakers?
Well, what Congress does is appropriate funds. So these are budgetary decisions about the spending. What the entire system of government, the executive, the White House, the State Department and the Pentagon then do is decide what to spend that money on, when and how it should be delivered. So that decision, the funding decision's already been made, but most of that has been committed, most of that money, nearly all of it. There's only a few billions outstanding. So the White House does have very significant authority to intervene here and specifically to stop some deliveries, which they're clearly doing.
All right. For the moment, Tom, thank you very much indeed. That's Tom Bateman there, live from Washington, D.C. Well, in the hours after that announcement to suspend U.S. military aid to Ukraine, the president of the European Commission, that's Ursula von der Leyen, unveiled a new European plan to considerably ramp up its defence spending. She said 800 billion euros would be freed up to boost Europe's military capabilities. But will that be enough investment, and how fast can Europe rearm? Earlier, I spoke to Shashank Joshi. He's defence editor of The Economist newspaper.
I think Europe has a money problem and a capability problem. Raising money requires a lot of convoluted bureaucratic techniques and tricks, and one of them is what we've seen today with a new defence fund and based on a relaxation of EU rules on budget deficits. There is also, however, a separate problem, which is money doesn't translate into weapons immediately. It can take years to build complex things like jets or surveillance planes. It can be very hard to find the industrial capacity to build new munitions.
And so looking at the US decision to suspend military aid to Ukraine, how long before that is felt on the battlefield, and what's the likely impact going to be? I mean, we heard from one Ukrainian MP saying it was catastrophic.
Assuming that this cutoff does not affect intelligence sharing and the provision of commercial services by American companies, notably Starlink, the communication satellites that are provided by Elon Musk's company SpaceX, then actually the impact should not be immediately catastrophic. Ukraine can probably plough on for months. It has stockpiles of ammunition. It's making a lot of its own strike drones. European aid will still be coming through. But eventually, over a period of some months, probably into the summer or beyond, you would begin to see air defense interceptors running out. You would see artillery firepower fall away. And things like spare parts and maintenance for American vehicles, armored vehicles, planes, that will come up and cause problems.
You mentioned the satellite coverage there. And this is a concern, isn't it? Because the US has been absolutely crucial on air cover, intelligence, also communications. We don't know whether that's been affected. But if it is, what would the impact of that be?
Starlink has been the backbone of Ukraine's military communications. It's been a vital service that is used in every Ukrainian military unit for flying drones, communicating back home, sending messages. There are some workarounds, things like using drones in the air as communication relays to send messages, but these are clunky, these aren't as effective, they aren't as secure. And so if that goes completely, you would see a significant and immediate disruption in Ukraine's military operations.
And a quick word on the Russian capability at the moment, because the narrative, certainly from Moscow, but even it's got to be said also now coming from Washington, is that Ukraine can't win this war. Clearly, Russia is the bigger side, but they've been looking rather desperate recently. They've been recruiting soldiers from North Korea. Is it still as strong as they claim?
What we're seeing in recent days and weeks is that Russia on the Eastern Front has been slowing down. It hasn't been doing as well. But more importantly than that, although, yes, it does have a population that is three times larger than Ukraine's, it's been suffering a very, very large number of casualties, far more than Ukraine's. And yes, it is replenishing those losses, but it is doing so at growing cost. It has to pay more salaries. It has to consider at some point wider mobilization, which could cause political problems. And it is starving its civilian economy to pay for all of this. In wars of attrition, what matters is the trajectory going forward. And I think if the Americans continue to support Ukraine, they could negotiate from a far stronger position. But what I see in the last weeks is on almost every front, everywhere I look, America seems to be throwing away its leverage, weakening its ally, and offering card after card to its rival, the Russians.
Shashank Joshi, their defence editor of The Economist. So what's the view from Ukraine 3 years into the defence of their nation from a foreign invading army? Today, the Ukrainian Prime Minister, Denis Shmyhal, told reporters that the country was firmly determined to continue cooperating with the United States. Let's speak now live to Ukrainian journalist Natalia Gumenuk, who is also the author of The Lost Island, Dispatches from Occupied Crimea. Natalia, thanks for coming on the programme. How would you describe the feeling in Ukraine today?
So it's not something which some of us didn't expect. And I, of course, Ukrainians didn't want to prepare that much for this particular moment because it's pretty abrupt. If we speak about the real withdrawal of the American support, it's definitely will cost a lot of lives because, you know, air defense saves Ukrainian lives. The weapon saves Ukrainian lives. So now we just figuring out how to navigate that, you know, for how to rationale, how to make, I think that the Ukrainian military are replanning, but it doesn't mean that it started today. Mm. It's like the thing which you expected but didn't want to speak aloud unless it's happened. Mm-hmm. You had it like a plan B you didn't want to happen. So, for instance, listening to your previous experts, little by little, Ukrainians were trying to be less dependent on the Starlink services, for instance. Starlink is still more, you know, user-friendly, let's say like that, and more present. But there were particular actions taking place. But of course, still, it's a very considerable aid. So for Ukraine, there are two ways in particular. That's how it feels. Yeah. In real life, to find the way to fight without the American aid, but on the rhetoric level, try to navigate communication with White House, okay, knowing clearly that the U.S. is not on our side any longer.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, obviously, there's a sense of disappointment, but is Washington still considered an ally by Ukraine?
You know, Washington is, you want to remain, have Washington in your orbit because Vladimir Putin really wants the conflict between the Europe and Washington. He wants to break this alliance. And in the end, you don't want to trust Russia. And I think you cannot trust Russia. So we won't believe in a really fruitful cooperation between Moscow and Washington in the long term. But it's necessary to navigate this period before. So okay, definitely it's hard to trust Washington any longer.
Very briefly, are Ukrainians ready to give up territory for the sake of peace?
It's not really about territories, and it was never that much about territories. It's really about these guarantees Ukrainians were speaking that much. Mm. The particular means that Russia won't invade again and won't use the post to accumulate okay, the weapon. So that's about, this is a different talk. So it's pretty unfortunate how this talk has been spinned, including by the White House.
Okay. Natalia, we must leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us live on the line there from Kyiv. Natalia Gumenuk. Still to come on the programme, we'll be speaking to the grandson of Australian blood donor James Harrison, who's said to have saved the lives of more than 2 million babies through his blood donations.
Oh, he was just a hard-working, nice bloke. Nothing would stop him from donating. Love the attention from the nurses. He's a little bit of a flirty bloke with them. He's a little cheeky, but he's all harmless. He's good. Good egg, but he's just granddad to us.
More on that interview to come. And a reminder of our headline this hour. Ukraine and its allies have expressed shock following Donald Trump's decision to suspend all military aid to Kyiv. Russia has welcomed the move, and the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has revealed plans to boost EU defence spending and speed up rearmament. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, Arab leaders are gathering in Cairo today to discuss an Egyptian plan for the reconstruction and future governance of Gaza. The plan comes exactly a month after the US President Donald Trump suggested America could take charge of the Gaza Strip with Palestinian civilians relocated to Egypt and Jordan. But for 6 weeks since the Gaza ceasefire was agreed, some Palestinians have gone back back to places that have seen some of the worst destruction of the war, and many of them are determined to stay, come what may. Paul Adams has this report from Jerusalem.
As Jabalia's residents return to the apocalyptic wasteland that was their home, the world has a lot to say of their future, and that of Gaza's more widely. It's been just a month since Donald Trump told them, in no uncertain terms, to leave.
The Gaza Strip, which has been a symbol of death and destruction for so many decades, should not go through a process of rebuilding and occupation by the same people that have really stood there and fought for it and lived there and died there and lived a miserable existence there.
Mr. Trump's proposal has, for now, rather faded from view. But while the world debates, those at the centre of that plan are simply getting on with living. Slowly, tentatively, Jabalia is coming back to life. Layla is doing the washing up in a sink where the tap dried up months ago, in a kitchen with a sheet hanging where the wall used to be.
It's so difficult. There is no water, no electricity, no life. We have to carry water in buckets from a long way away, climb the stairs, and sewage is everywhere. There isn't even any food.
Layla's parents were of a generation of Palestinians who fled or were driven from their homes during the creation of the State of Israel more than 75 years ago. Having only just returned to Jabalia, she's not about to leave now.
Because Trump wants us to leave, I won't leave. I want to travel by my own will. I won't leave because of him.
Layla's husband, Marwan, seems less determined. He sounds angry and tired.
I don't want to stay here even for a minute. If I had a chance to leave, I would leave. I had a good life here once. Now it's hell.
Nabil is living in the same house, one of very few in the centre of Jabalia still standing, even if it lacks windows, doors, and in some places, entire walls. From what an enterprising estate agent might call an impressive picture window, in fact a gaping hole, he looks out on an undulating ocean of ruin.
Here you can see the destruction. They want us to leave without rebuilding it. How can we leave? How can we leave when it's still destroyed? The least we can do is rebuild it for our children. With God's will, we will rebuild it.
Galvanized into action by Donald Trump's vision of an American-owned depopulated Gaza, Arab leaders are trying to come up with an alternative plan. Gazans will stay put during reconstruction. There will be a temporary Palestinian administration in which Hamas will not play a role. But for now, Gazans are simply making the most of the ceasefire. Take Sana, looking to revive her wedding dress business on the ground floor of a building so shattered it's hard to believe it's still standing. Sana's attachment to Jabalia is deep.
I love it very much. I will not leave here until I die. I will not leave. People ask me why I want to stay. I tell them I don't really know.
Outside the entrance to Sana's shop, a mannequin sports a creamy white wedding dress, a dazzling image of optimism in the midst of so much chaos, suffering and uncertainty. But right now, Israel and Hamas are locked in a dispute over how to keep the fragile ceasefire going. If it can't be resolved, then wedding dresses and Arab peace plans could all soon be blown away.
Paul Adams with that report. So what do we know of the Egyptian plan for the reconstruction and development of Gaza? I've been speaking to Mohammed Hegazi. He's a former Egyptian assistant foreign minister and is across all the details of the plan.
This is a comprehensive structure of a plan divided into three phases. The immediate relief phase, which will stay with us for 6 months, in which we will create safe havens and supported areas with electricity and water. Then after this 6 month relief activities, we will move into the second plan, which will start by a reconstruction conference in which Egypt and the UN will call international partners and Arab countries who want really to contribute to this very important project with an estimate cost by the UN of $53 billion. The second phase will address also the governing of Gaza. But before we end with this point, we have to refer to the third and most important phase, which is also calling for a peace conference where the two-state solution will be addressed. The reconstruction phase, which will contain a political horizon, is a very important phase in which we will address all what is related to long-term and sustainable reconstruction in all fields.
The very first thing you mentioned were safe havens. Now, just to clarify, that would be within Gaza. The suggestion isn't that people would leave, as has been proposed by Donald Trump. The people would stay in Gaza and then there'd be reconstruction, temporary shelters and so on while the rebuilding of Gaza takes place. This is going to be very expensive, isn't it? How is this going to be funded?
We will call for an international reconstruction conference where pledges will be offered by neighboring Arab countries or by the international community and the world financial institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and different banks.
You mentioned the need for a political settlement and this going back to the two-state solution. But how is the security going to be secured to enable this? And are there any conditions attached to it in terms of would you be requiring Hamas to step aside? Because we heard from them today in a statement saying that disarming Hamas would be a red line for them.
Well, between Fatah and Hamas, they were a discussion in Egypt for a few months and they completed an agreement to establish what they call it the Palestinian Social Support Committee. This social support committee will run and govern the Gaza Strip as okay. well as but a Palestinian police.
What about Hamas? Because, you know, they can have a police
you
force or
about,
another.
Yeah, they will not have a police force. The police force is the residual of the Palestinian police that was left and didn't leave after the coup of Hamas in 2007. So this is Palestinian police that will be also supported by Egypt and international like kind of peacekeeping during this 5 years project.
But
the Hamas disarmament is another issue that nobody in this very important moment is talking about. We are talking about Hamas to step from governing Gaza. So Hamas will not be disarmed. This is not in the intention, as in your case in Ireland, for example. The IRA did not step aside and give their arms to the UN until you signed in the Good Friday Agreement. We need to give the Palestinian a light at the end of the tunnel, which in our case, the two-state solution.
Mohammed Hegazi, their former Egyptian assistant foreign minister, on the plans, the Egyptian plan being put forth today, right now, actually, in Cairo, as Arab leaders are gathered there to discuss it. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, obesity has been a known global health crisis for a while, but new research suggests that by 2050, more than half of all adults worldwide and a third of children will be overweight or obese. The research is published in the medical journal The Lancet and shows that unhealthy weight levels have more than doubled in the past 30 years. So what are the implications of that and what, if anything, can be done about it? I've been speaking to Johanna Ralston, the chief executive of the World Obesity Forum, and I asked her if these figures are a result of governments not taking the problem seriously.
We actually feel that governments, while recognizing it, are looking for more clear direction. In some cases, no, there's great misunderstanding among governments and even indeed some bias among policymakers who still, I think, are looking at it from a perspective of this is the individual's fault. All you need to do is just eat less and move more. Our understanding of obesity has evolved enormously over the past decade or so in terms of understanding that it really is a complex, chronic, multifactorial disease and a driver of other diseases. Yet I don't think that that knowledge and understanding have made its way into policy recommendations or certainly not policy recommendations that governments can use.
So what are some of the other factors then? Because this research points to the fact that it's in lower and middle income countries that the rise is happening fastest.
Yes, we are starting to see some flattening of rates in higher income countries. But what is really continues to be really alarming is the degree to which this has become a low and middle income country problem. We did an assessment showing that of the top 10 countries in terms of numbers of people living with obesity by 2030, 9 will be middle income countries. So it's really become a global problem and requires a globally coordinated response.
But in terms of what some of the factors driving this could be, I mean, things like ultra-processed foods and so on, they're far more prevalent now than they were 30-odd years ago. Could that be part of the cause, not just a sedentary lifestyle?
Absolutely. That is a contributing factor. So again, yes, ultra-processed foods and increased physical inactivity. Certainly measures have been taken to address all of these, reduction of sugar-sweetened beverages, marketing restrictions. All of those are helpful, but they're not done in a significantly ambitious or coordinated way. Mm-hmm. And there is still pushback from industry on some of those measures. More broadly, I think the response has been fragmented. It's one of those issues where obesity is a bit everywhere and nowhere. An integrated approach is in some ways the only approach that will really work, where you address the obesogenic environment, the health system, the food system, all in a coordinated way.
All this is happening as we see the explosion of weight loss drugs taking off across the world. Many hope that this could be a quick fix to the problem. What's your view on that?
As you might guess, I don't think there are quick fixes, but any therapies, any treatment needs to sit within a health system that is monitoring and addressing this at the earliest possible ages so that people can have options for healthier diets, for more physically active lifestyles, and for different treatments where appropriate.
And that was Johanna Ralston there, Chief Executive of the World Obesity Forum, speaking to us earlier. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby, and there's been news coming in on the stock markets this morning that around the world they've been falling. This is because of the news that President Trump says he is going ahead with his decision to impose tariffs. Here he is announcing that tariffs on Canada, Mexico and China begin today.
Tariffs 25% on Canada and 25% on Mexico, and that'll start. So they're going to have a tariff. So what they have to do is build their car plants, frankly, and other things in the United States, in which case they have no tariffs.
Well, with us now on the line is Gillian Tett. She's head of King's College Cambridge and also a columnist for the Financial Times. Gillian, thanks so much for coming on. This sounds pretty serious, is it?
It is absolutely very serious indeed. And the problem people are facing is that they've had a situation of the boy crying wolf in the last few months, where Trump has repeatedly, President Trump, threatened to impose tariffs and then backed down at the last minute. And I think most people didn't actually quite believe he was going to go through with this, but he is going through with it, so he claims. And we've had a very strong reaction from the stock market, which is essentially saying, we think this is going to be very bad for the global economy and for businesses. And then just this morning, we had Target, or Target, as they say in America, one of the biggest retailers, coming out and saying very specifically that these tariffs are going to cut into profits and, you know, create, they said, meaningful year over year profit pressure because of the disruptions to trade.
So, I mean, would you call this a trade war? Is it global? Who's going to be the most affected?
Well, it's absolutely a trade war as far as America is concerned, and it's taking us right back to the protectionist era of the 1930s. And as everyone knows, that ended very badly. However, it's worth pointing out that in many ways, America is acting on its own initiative right now, in that it is creating these tariffs. Countries are retaliating, but other countries are actually starting to trade a lot more with each other. So it's not the case that global trade as a whole is collapsing. What's happening essentially is America is throwing a hand grenade into its own dealings with other countries, even as other countries try and trade around it.
So what is the Trumpian logic of all of this then? Because won't it actually affect American consumers possibly worst of all?
Well, what Donald Trump would say is really two or three things. Firstly, he claims that America has been taken advantage of by other countries and has been very weak. And he's trying to demonstrate strength on the world stage by acting, frankly, a bit like a playground bully. Secondly, though, he's also trying to boost the American economy, ironically, by persuading countries to bring their, persuading companies to bring their production and manufacturing into America and therefore hire a lot more American workers. And he believes very strongly, as does his team, Scott Bessent, and who's the Treasury Secretary and others, that China and other low-cost manufacturing bases have been undercutting America and stealing, they would say, American jobs, because it's been so much cheaper and easier to manufacture there rather than America.
But the prices for shoppers in America could actually have quite serious political consequences for Mr. Trump, potentially.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest political issues right now is the price of eggs. And there's a real concern amongst consumers that prices are going to go up. Surveys show that consumer confidence, having surged at the end of last year, is actually now declining quite markedly. And consumers are braced for a lot more inflation ahead. Mm. So perhaps the most interesting question is, at what point does Trump respond to the potential for a populist backlash against what he's doing? Or can he simply deliver the kind of economic miracle he's promised that will keep people happy? And frankly, at the moment, he's trying to deliver a policy of what might be called bread and circuses, to go back to the Roman emperors, where he's trying to distract the voters by all kinds of dramatic gestures around Ukraine and everything else. And he keeps promising them that they'll get the bread, they'll get lots of economic benefits going forward. But the reality is that voters aren't seeing that yet.
Okay, for the moment, Gillian Tett, thank you very much indeed for joining us live. To Australia now, where tributes are being paid to a prolific blood donor who's just died at the age of 88. It's thought that the blood plasma donated by James Harrison saved around 2.4 million babies. Mr. Harrison had a rare blood type that contained an antibody known as anti-D, and the antibody is given to women whose own immune system attacks the red blood cells of her unborn child. Mr. Harrison donated every fortnight for decades, and the Australian Red Cross Blood Service called him the man with the golden arm. Here he is speaking almost a decade ago.
It becomes quite humbling when they say, oh, you've done this or you've done that, or you're a hero. No. I said, it's something I can do. You know? It's one of my talents. Probably my only talent is that I can be a blood donor.
Well, earlier I spoke to his grandson, Jared Mellowship, and he told me more about him.
Oh, he was just a hard-working, nice bloke. Always looked after us. He just made sure he donated his blood every 2 weeks, and that's it. Loved his travelling, but even when he was travelling, he had to donate his blood.
How did he do that when he was on the road?
He would find a blood bank, no matter where he was. I know every winter he would go to Queensland for 3 months because it's warmer up there, up in the tropic, and he found a blood bank at Maroochydore, and he'd go there every 2 weeks. And he'd time it so that he could always donate no matter where he was.
And, I mean, this does sound as if this was a thing that he took incredibly seriously.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Wouldn't give it up for anything. Well, he just felt like he had to give back to, you know, the cause that kind of saved his life. I think he had a lung removed when he was 14. And in that surgery, he took a whole heap of blood. And that's what they believe, or from what I know, has created this thing he's got in his blood, or had in his blood, because he took in a whole heap of different blood types when he had this transfusion. So that was when he was 14. So he swore that when he turned 18, he would start donating blood back. And then as it progressed, they found he had this special stuff, and here we are today.
Really? Okay. So that's fascinating. Yeah. So his plasma contained this rare antibody, didn't it, known as anti-D. And it's very rare. Hardly anybody's got it, which I guess is why he wanted to make sure that he was donating. And I understand he also donated to your mother for your birth. Is that right?
Yeah, mum had to have the injection so then I could have a brother. So then Scott was born, and then mum had another injection with Scott in case they had another baby but didn't.
Right. I mean, the Australian Red Cross Blood Service have been paying their tributes to him, saying, you know, how many pints of blood he donated. It's into the thousands, isn't it, over the decades.
Oh, yeah.
He was giving blood, saved over 2 million children. They called him the man with the golden arm.
Yep, that's what he's always been known as.
And since he passed away, lots of people have been paying tributes to him, including many of the people whose lives he effectively saved.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Everyone's kind of not coming out of the woodworks, but how, you know, this injection was able to create their babies and all that kind of stuff. And without that, they, you know, might not have had children and families quite similar to my family. My wife had to have the injection 3 times so that we could have our 4 kids.
Really? Goodness
so,
me.
Yeah.
Quite a legacy then.
Yeah, no, it's pretty humbling. No, he was just a man set in his ways. Nothing would stop him from donating. Love the attention from the nurses. He's a little bit of a flirty bloke with them.
Right.
You know, he's a little cheeky, but he was all right. It was all harmless. He's good. Good egg.
You must be very proud of him.
Oh, of course. Of course. But he's just granddad to us.
Mm-hmm. And that was Jared Mellowship there speaking about his granddad, James Harrison. Now to a very distressing story. The UN children's charity UNICEF is calling for urgent international efforts to protect and support children in Sudan. UNICEF has been collecting data showing that hundreds of children have been raped and sexually assaulted by armed men during the continuing civil war, which erupted in Sudan in April 2023. Millions of people have been displaced by the conflict, which is leaving many children and also women vulnerable. In September, the BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher was in the country speaking with women there.
Just outside the capital city is a crossing between the warring parties. These women have come out of RSF territory. They carry bags to buy food and also tales of horror.
There are women here who have been raped, but they don't talk about it. They hide it. What difference would it make if they speak? What can we do? Tell me, what can we do?
I asked them why they didn't leave. We're too poor, they told me. We have nowhere else to go.
The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher reporting a few months ago from Sudan. Well, this latest research is very shocking and upsetting, but nonetheless very important. Let's get more details now with Tess Ingram from UNICEF. She was involved in compiling the report. Tess, what did you find?
We found data and stories that really were beyond our worst expectations. We knew that there was a somewhat hidden sexual violence crisis in Sudan, with children really, you know, among the survivors there. And the data that we've now released today tells us that there are 221 children who have been raped in Sudan since the beginning of 2024, two-thirds girls and one-third boys. And the youngest survivors I think among the most startling findings of this research, there are 16 children under the age of 5, including 4 one-year-olds in that cohort. They're recorded in 9 states from north to south to east to west of Sudan. So this is a widespread issue that is affecting children of all ages. And I think it should ring alarm bells across the world today to try and drive action to protect these children from this ongoing violence.
As you say, the country's been in chaos, hasn't it, for years, and various armed groups as well as the two main warring parties. So has it been possible to get any support through to these children and helping them deal with the trauma they must continue to suffer?
They do, and this was one of the things that I heard when I spoke to these children in Sudan when I was there meeting with them in December, that after experiencing the horrors of rape or sexual harassment, the suffering doesn't end. And for many reasons in Sudan, one, as you say, because access to service is incredibly difficult in the world's largest humanitarian crisis, where hospitals have been decimated and medical staff are again operating under threats for their own life, but also because of social stigma. People are afraid to come forward and talk about what had happened to them, like we heard Barbara reporting on there, because in Sudan, like in many other contexts, it's the survivors, not the perpetrators, who carry that cultural burden of shame and stigma for the rape. So been very brave for the families that we spoke to, including these children, to come forward and speak about what has happened to them.
And I suppose it means that there could be even more victims than you managed to find briefly.
That's right. We think that this is the tip of the iceberg, unfortunately.
OK, well, thank you very much for coming on to explain that harrowing story for us there. As I say, very important to hear it, though. Thank you, Tess Ingram from UNICEF. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. A leader of the M23 rebels who have swept through the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has told the BBC they will go all the way to the capital, Kinshasa, which is about 1,000 miles or so away, if they come under attack from the government forces. Corne Nangar, who heads an alliance which includes the M23, claims that they're liberators defending themselves against the government in Kinshasa. The M23, who according to the United States and the United Nations are backed by neighbouring Rwanda, now controls Goma and Bukavu, the two largest cities in the mineral-rich east. Rwanda denies backing the rebel fighters. Well, the UN says that almost 3,000 people have been killed in the battle to capture Goma in late January, and our senior international correspondent Orla Geerin has been speaking to Mr. Nangar in Goma, and she began by asking him for his response to that UN death toll.
I've not seen the 3,000 people. You know, Goma is a small city. I know that they were fighting in the city, but it's amazing to see that in a city like Goma, 3,000 people was killed, I don't know, but I don't see the family who are mourning.
But families have been in the morgue, families have been collecting bodies.
And when you see the population, how they welcomed us, it's just amazing.
Just to be clear, are you saying that 3,000 people were not killed here?
No, I don't, this is a lie.
Are you planning to continue your advance, to continue pushing forward and taking control of more territory?
Depending on Kinshasa, so far as they will attack us, and then we will defend ourselves.
So you say you will only respond if you are being attacked?
We respond and we take away the threat.
But you have also said you will go all the way to Kinshasa.
So if the threat is in Kinshasa, we'll go there.
What are your relations with Rwanda? UN experts say there are up to 4,000 troops here from Rwanda fighting with you, that they train the M23, they arm the M23, they have effective control over the M23.
I don't know anything about Rwanda. If they say that there are 4,000 fighters from Rwanda, I don't know, I didn't see them. But for me, we have a Congolese problem. I am a Congolese man. I believe that our problem is to be sorted out, not by other countries, but by Congolese themselves.
Are you saying that there are no Rwandan troops here and you have no connection with Rwanda?
Saying that I don't have connection with Rwanda, I will lie. You see the border? You cannot live in Goma without Rwanda, and Rwanda can never live without Goma.
So you don't receive any assistance from Rwanda?
I don't see the military assistance from Rwanda.
So even though there is photographic evidence of Rwandan troops here in DRC, you say they are not here and not fighting with you?
They can have their evidence. Me, I say that I don't have those evidence. We have our own reason why we are fighting.
And you're not being helped by Rwanda?
I don't know. I'm not talking about Rwanda. I'm no Rwandese.
Is there a plan to try to join the east of Congo to Rwanda?
Never. We remain Congolese. A Congo is going to remain the same country. No Balkanization is not in our agenda at all.
Human rights groups have accused the M23 over the past few years of a whole range of abuses, of systematic shelling, of mass rape, of killing of civilians. They say this has been carried out by M23 fighters, and they have documented these cases. What's your response?
I didn't see the report. I know I cannot respond for the report that I didn't read.
Are you not worried about these allegations?
No,
they've been made for years.
No, I've never read those allegations. And also, we are also writing our own report for all these issues.
If a body like the UN or the Red Cross or Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, if all of these people are saying the M23 is carrying out human rights abuses, do you not wish to look into that?
No, I think they are not the right people to make reports on this kind of issue. And for the other reports, I've not read them.
But these reports have been made over years. Why have you not read them until now?
Give me one, then I will be reading it.
I can send you many.
Please. Appreciate.
Do you want to be the next president of Congo?
This is not our aim. Our aim is to fight against corruption. We are fighting because there are people who are denied their citizenship. We have our reason why we are fighting. This is the reason. Our objective is not to become the president.
And that was rebel leader Corne Nangar speaking to our senior international correspondent Ola Guerin there, who joins us live on the line now. Ola, can you tell us a little bit more about this leader in terms of who he is, his background, and how many people he leads?
Well, he has emerged very much as the public face of a new alliance, the Congo River Alliance, which includes the M23 rebel fighters. Now, he himself is not a military commander, although these days he sometimes pops up in combat fatigues. But he is very much being put forward as the face of the movement. His background is in government. He was a technocrat. He was, in fact, part of the election machinery in the DRC. And controversially, he certified the election victory of the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, when he was elected in 2018 in a disputed election. But since then, he has moved to oppose the president. He is part of this alliance. They are presenting themselves as challenging a failed state. These are the words he uses. Mm. And crucially, what many in Congo point to is the fact that he does not belong to the ethnic Tutsi minority group. Previously, the M23 has always been seen as representing the interests of Tutsis, who they say face discrimination. Yeah. Corne Nangar is not from that minority, and that is seen by people as an attempt to create a broader appeal, if you like, on the part of the M23.
And very briefly, Ola, the situation now in the east around Goma, do the M23 and other rebels have ambitions to expand the territory they hold?
Well, they've been consolidating their grip on Goma and Bukavu, the two largest cities in the east. They've been continuing to advance in South Kivu. They have been strengthening their control over supply routes to Rwanda and also control over strategic water resources. So they're putting themselves in a strong position. They've said they'll keep going forward if the government keeps attacking them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us live on the line there. That's our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin, bringing us to an end to this edition of NewsHour. From me and the whole team here in London, thanks very much for joining us.